I'm going to go back a ways. You grew up in Coney Island, and while your father died when you were young, I have the feeling that your family was probably not unlike Bruce Gould's family in Good as Gold. Is that right?
My family was very much unlike Bruce Gould's. It was more like families that the friends of mine spoke about. I did not have a large family. I had a brother and one sister, and the family was not at all like mine. At one point in each in the book, I did reproduce something almost verbatim that my sister had written for me and my brother had written for me. And the sister Rose, she has a birthday party, and she remembers laughingly what it was like to get out of high school and depression and go to work. So I wrote to my sister and I asked her to tell me, because she had told me before, and she wrote down her work experience, and Rose gives that one. And then Gold's brother Sid. My brother was born in Europe and did come over on a boat when he was about 4, 5, or 6 years old, and does remember very well how he had never seen an orange before, and the first time they served him, he was afraid to take it. Then he took a taste, and he liked it. The next day he wanted another one, but they were out of oranges. So I have Sid in that lunch in the Russian tea room. I had my brother write me a letter, and that's broken up into a dialogue. My sister's letter was presented almost a monologue. Other than that, there was really no similarities, except for living in Coney Island at that same time that I did.
Who was the prototype of that terrible father?
He's a composite of fathers that I've heard about from other people. He was not my own, because my father died when I was 5. Some of his traits came from the father of one person, other of his traits come from the other, from others, and he is presented largely as a cartoon figure, as a caricature, but toward the end he is the only one that shows, he's not the only one, he shows a streak of integrity that embarrasses Gold very much.
Was there anything, as you were growing up in Coney Island, that may have prefigured your future as a writer?
No, other than the fact that I wanted to be a writer, and even in elementary school, I knew I was excelling at things like book reports and what was called compositions. Now they're probably called themes. I would bring more imagination into the assignment than others. Of fellow students would, and almost inevitably I would be called upon to read mine aloud. And encouraged and emboldened by that, I think before I was 13, I wrote a short story and submitted it to the New York Daily News. Used to publish a short story every day. It was rejected, of course, but that's not the Coney Island experience. Desire to be a writer would have probably come to me that way, I believe, no matter where I lived, because I was living in my mind a lot. I realize now, looking back, I did have a tendency to daydream a lot, and still do have a tendency to daydream a lot. And what I've managed to do in a practical way was to control my daydreams, so I would daydream only about material that would go into a novel I was writing.
Were you a reader as well?
Yes, I read a lot. At that time, there was no television. My brother and sister, older than I, would work in the city, and it's a subway ride about an hour from the house. And there was something then, every drugstore had one called a circulating library, where for 15 cents you took a book out. There were always contemporary books, current best-selling books. And when they were in the house, I would read them. So I read a lot, but I was not reading what would be called good literature. When I came in contact with good literature, it was kind of a jolt. It took me many, many years to be able to read novels in which dialogue and melodramatic actions were not the key part.
No, nobody starts reading good literature.
Mm-hmm.
We always start with the things that we like.
Oh, yeah.
Then we move into things we don't like, and then it takes us a while to appreciate.
Oh, yeah.
After the service, you got into advertising and promotion, and I presume that experience that helped you draft the business world of Bob Slocum.
It helped me write Catch 22. I wrote Catch 22 while I was writing promotional advertising copy for a series of companies. Remington Rand was one, and then Time Magazine and Look and McCall's. And because of the nature of Catch 22, with its abrupt transitions and unexpected introduction of the novel, the unpredictable. I felt there was a similarity between writing Catch-22 and the work I was called upon to do in the daytime, where promotion and advertising is supposed to, if it's done well, there should be some catchy, snappy, unexpected opening. And I would bring as much as I imagination, intelligence to put into play in my daily work as I would into Catch-22 in the evening. That work environment did supply the setting for something happened. And particularly it was Time Magazine, which was the best place in the world a person could work for then, and may still be, as far as security goes, employing benefits, time, extra days off, long lunch hours, expense accounts. It was very comfortable there.
Security.
What I say about Slocum, when he describes the company, the company's never named. When he says the company never fires anybody, I don't think anybody ever got fired at Time Magazine. Then.
People live in such abject terror.
Well, that's if something happened on Time Magazine. I'm talking about the environment. The terror is, I don't know where it comes from. That same place that the word something comes from. I mean, Slocum says something happened. The word something is chosen very carefully. He can't explain it. He says it on the first page, something must have happened to me somewhere to make me the way I am. It's not job insecurity, though, because I don't think any time in the book does Slocum complain about the job or about being underpaid or about being threatened with being fired. The anxiety, the terror he feels is self-imposed, and what he sees in the salesman may be endemic to the job, that if they have a good year, they're expected to have a better year, and they're always conscious of that. But the organization itself does not threaten Slocum, not economically. He lives in fear, but it's not the fear that comes from, he has the men he works for something of a bully, but I don't believe he's ever threatened with being fired. And almost from the beginning of the book, one of the things that happens to him is that the promise of a promotion is offered him. And that's really the threat on which the book hinges. So he's not in danger from the company. And I think when I worked there, I don't believe anybody ever got fired. There were many unhappy people. And I believe the company did have an arrangement with Payne Whitney. but as far as benefits go, there was nothing in my experience. I went to work there, I think, on December 28th or 29th of one year. And that summer, I got a four-week vacation at a time when I believe four-week vacations did not exist for anybody.
Back to Catch-22 for a second. That came out of 64, wasn't it?
No, 1961.
61?
Yeah.
That was not. It's now
a classic. You can call it a classic, because other people do, yes.
Satire, I guess. But it was not an instant hit, was it?
It was not an instant hit. The reviews in the most important places were atrocious. If it got reviewed at all, reviews in places like the Sunday Times and New York Magazine were very uncomplimentary. No, it was not an instant hit in the sense that it was a bestseller. It was not a bestseller. Never made a bestseller list. And it did not produce much money for me. I didn't leave my job at McCall's until it was out close to a year. And when Columbia Pictures bought the movie rights, then I had enough money to leave my job. I was making then at McCall's Magazine what I consider a good salary. Certainly is enough for me and my two children. It was about $19,000 a year. I did not earn that much from Catch-22 the first year until the movie rights were sold.
Catch-22 has never been out of print, has it?
It's never been out of print. I don't think every once in a while it goes out of print in some small foreign country, but only because the publishing company fails and immediately another company brings it back into print. I get royalty checks from just about every country in which it was ever published, in like 25 or 30 countries.
You should be able to live on Catch-22.
Yeah, I get some of the royalty checks are $6.13.
I should know this, but I don't. Did the phrase Catch-22?
I invented it.
You invented that. You gave us the language.
I enriched the language enormously by giving a number to the expression as a catch. I didn't invent the catchy phrase catch. I mean, there's only one catch or there's always a catch. That's part of the vernacular. I decided to give it a number and give it the status of an army regulation or some obscure provision which could be evoked legally. but which, as the book develops, is revealed, does not exist, which makes it even more sinister and more oppressive, because if it doesn't exist, it can't be taken out of existence.
Didn't you write a short story or a novel, a novella or something, with a different, slightly different title?
No, I published the first chapter of the book. Originally it was called Catch 18.
Oh.
And the first chapter of the book was published in 1955, so many years before I finished the book, in an anthology then called New World Writing Number 7. So that's why it's, if you look at the copyright page of Catch 22, it will say copyright 1955 and 1961. Then the title was changed because when it was ready to be published, ready for type to be set, Leon Uris, who was a far better known novelist than I was, announced he was publishing a book called Mila 18 that same month. And my publisher, in their wisdom, felt that the public would not want to buy two novels with the number 18 in the title of the same season. If they had a choice, they would pick yours over mine. So that's why the number was changed.
Lucky you.
I don't know.
Were you writing short stories?
I wrote short stories while I was an undergraduate college student. I didn't go to college until after World War II. I had no college before. I never would have gone to college. We could not have afforded it. So I was a freshman at age 22, and at age 23 I took a short story course and writing course at New York University. Did well there, too, compared to the other students. With the same arrogance that I had when I was 9 years old, I submitted every story to every magazine. And to my surprise, Esquire began a purchase too, in Atlantic Monthly. So I was publishing short stories when I was a sophomore. By the time I was a senior, I had learned enough as an English major to appreciate that these stories were practically worthless, and they were imitations of Ernest Hemingway, I wasn't sure. And so then there was a period when I stopped writing for 3, 4, or 5 years until I got the idea for Catch-22, which was the first novel I ever started. I've had only 4 ideas for novels in my lifetime, and they've all been published. I've not started a novel that I didn't complete.
The late Walter Tevis, who wrote The Hustler and The Man Who Fell to Earth, told me that his fear was in repeating himself. His theory was that writers always write the same book, and that the problem was to disguise it. But that is not the case with you. There is nothing similar about any... I mean, every one of these books is different from the other.
Well, there is a similarity which I've come to recognize, because we're talking now over, let's say, a 30-year period. Catch-22 was published in 1961. It was started in 1953. I know there are certain similarities. There is a use of ironic humor, and there is a preoccupation with certain... certain morbid aspects of life, particularly the inevitability of growing old, the fact that one's parents normally will decline in health and become dependent and die, and then my protagonist is in that succession. Yosarian, though young, is very much preoccupied with the danger of disease and the danger of accidents. And it's one thing that all of my books have in common. And I think what is weighing most heavily on my King David's mind, and God knows, and he reviews a life in which is chock full of episodes, more than a normal life would have, and almost all of them are present in the Books of Samuel. What's weighing most heavily on his mind at the time he is telling his story is his realization of the proximity to death. He doesn't bewail that the way that Yosarian or Gold or Slocum does. But he knows he's close to death, and he misses his God. And he wants his God at that time. He feels he needs him. Now, in that part of the Old Testament, I don't think at any point is there a mention of an afterlife. The decline and the dust, going back to dust from which he came, was regarded as natural. But David would like at least some contact with God before he goes.
Let's talk about David for a bit. Research for God Knows. Did that take the mere presence of a Bible?
The research was very superficial as regards to research from all my novels. I discovered very early that I am not what could be called a realistic novel. I can't deal with facts comfortably. The few times I try to write articles based on actual things, the success was... the result was less than mediocre. So in all my novels, I try very hard not to let facts get in the way of the truth. For this book, it meant reading the Bible, not the whole Bible, reading those two books of Samuel, beginning of Kings, then reading most of the books leading up to those books of Samuel, and detecting in doing so certain common threads in those family scenes that are depicted from the very first one involving Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel that are repeated in David's life, reading beyond the books of Samuel to Ecclesiastes, which was possibly the book I was most familiar with, and knowing, taking out paragraphs and lines that I would put into David's mouth that would apply to his sentiments or his attitude, and then reading the songs, the Songs of Solomon, there too for descriptive language I wanted. Buying a book that I found in a bookstore called Life in Biblical Times, and then buying another book I think is called Encyclopedia of the Bible. And that's pretty much it. Late, when I was close to completing the book, there were passages in a narrative that were beyond my comprehension. I just could not make coherent sense out of it. I knew that there's much in the narrative of the Bible as we get it. It is an amalgam of four different versions of the narrative part. So I did buy, I joined the book club and it was offering revised standard, authorized, I forget what it was. It was supposedly an improvement over the King James Version. I did buy, and that had large number of footnotes which helped explain certain things, failed to explain others. And that was pretty much all the research I did.
King David's voice, he's...
That's not his.
Well, I was wondering about it. He's so loquacious and charming. I just wonder how you got... How do you picture David? Do you picture that David would have spoken that way?
No. David would not have spoken that way. I would have spoken that way. Maybe Norman Mailer would have spoken that way. Maybe Gore Vidal would. I mean, I think one of the first lines by which he characterized himself is a boastful one. I've got the best book in the Bible. I got the best story in the Bible, is what he says. That is not David speaking, the biblical David. It's not any character in the Bible speaking. David has possibly the longest narrative story of any character in the Old Testament. Jacob's may be another one, but you find David enters when he's young. He enters twice, which is one of the inconsistencies in the text. One, he enters to play for Saul, and then a year or 2 years later, he re-enters to fight Goliath. Neither he nor Saul make any reference to their having met before. But from that time on, we stay with David, David's life up until the time he's 70, and so much has happened to him that is there. It is a story in the Bible that is just filled with hair-raising escapes, with chases, with banditry, with murder, with war, with sex.
What a wonderful time.
Oh, yeah.
You certainly do a number on Solomon. I think you call Solomon a putz in the book.
Well, David called Solomon a putz. What would you call a man who wants to cut a baby in half just to show how fair he can be?
I always thought that was the wisdom of Solomon. You know, I never thought much about that. I just thought if it was in the Bible, it has to be right.
Well, no, I mean, people assume it. David reveals. He says, I'll let you in on a secret about my son Solomon. When he really wanted to cut that baby in half. He was trying to be fair, not crafty. Now that, I must tell you, I invented.
Well, it's certainly a satiric look at our heroes and villains in the Bible. Have you had any flack from the religious people yet?
Not yet.
Are you girding your loins for it?
No, I've gotten... all of my books have produced letters from people taking... And I'm talking about... people who are not obviously mad. I mean, they're angry. All of my books produce letters of criticism and objection. Some of them are temperate. They chastise me for certain attitudes, and some I reply to, and some I don't. I have a tendency, the four books are similar in this other respect. They do deal with subjects in a way almost intended to be either irreverent or iconoclastic or abrasive, and I'm always, my feelings are always hurt at the beginning that I'm as successful as I am. and of course, if I stop to think, certain people are going to object, even to Catch-22. The attitudes towards such things as military superiors, political superiors, definition of patriotism, a definition of courage. The question is raised many times in Catch-22, not in relation to World War II. Neither Yossarian nor I ever questioned the need of this country to participate in the war against fascism. But the question was raised since, I think, during the Vietnam War, whether it takes more courage to refuse to fight than it does to fight.
Did the Guillain-Barré come as you were working on that?
Yes. I just finished a long third chapter, and the final version of that third chapter is divided into three or four or five chapters. But I remember having a woman who did my typing for me calling her up that Sunday. She called me to say she had this third chapter typed, and I said, well, bring it over to her. I gave her the address of the medical intensive care. I called her back, but I know they're going to the hospital. I said, I'm not feeling so hot. I said, bring it up to the medical intensive care unit at Mount Sinai. And she brought it. I think I had no pain, I had no fever, I had no physical discomfort other than gradually being unable to move my arms and my legs and my head. My mind was always clear. So on that day, and it was a Sunday, I assumed, okay, I'm going to be in the hospital for 3-4 days, I'll be weak. I, an author of some 30 years, did not understand what the word weak meant, even though I probably used it 1,000 times in my book. I thought weak would mean feeling the way I'll feel when this program's over, a little sleepy, a little tired. So she brought them there, and that was page 325 of the book, which is about a little more than a third of the book. By the next day, I wasn't able to read those pages for 4 months. I couldn't lift them up or handle pages after that. And I was struck by this similarity, ironically, and I was one of the few people who knew it, that here was nature repeating art. My King David is 70 years old. As far as we know, he doesn't get out of his bed. He's too weak for anything. He's chilly, and he has to be taken care of in every respect. And here was I in a bed in Mount Sinai Hospital, soon unable to move, unable to swallow. At least King David can eat and take a big belt of wine from a flask, but every once in a while, I couldn't swallow. My first symptom was an inability to swallow, and I was very much aware of that. Other people came to visit me, began making jokes about my similarity to the soldier in white who appears in Catch-22.
You're chuckling now, but that must have been a terrifying...
No, I chuckled a lot all through the illness. The only time I was frightened would be at night when nothing was going on. I did not realize how serious it would be. The doctors told me the doctor's examination took place on a Sunday. It was kind of miraculous to get specialists to take care of me, and I'm very grateful to them. I called my internist who diagnosed it on the telephone, and usually it's a very difficult disease to diagnose. He asked me to come over to his house and arrange for a neurologist to look at me, and they knew what I did not, that it was going to be progressive. It was a disease of the peripheral nervous system. And what the neurologist told me, he asked me a few questions, had I been ill, had I had a viral attack, and I said no. He said, you're probably going to have a mild case, and I want you to know you'll get everything back. I, being very cautious and cunning, was smart enough not to ask him what I was going to lose or what he meant when he said I was going to get everything back. So I did not know how weak I was going to become. I did not know how long it was going to take. I began to get frightened and irritable and depressed as I began to recover at the rehabilitation hospital. And then I knew enough about the disease to know that while most people make what's called a full recovery, many people do not. I also knew enough about the disease to know what they meant when it was going to be slow, because almost 6 months had gone by, and I still could not sit up in bed or get out of a chair to a standing position. That's when I really became consciously frightened. Because I also knew then that there was nothing anybody could do and no way to predict the extent of recovery.
You certainly look robust now.
I look great in the intensive care unit for the first week or two. Nurses coming on seeing me for the first time, their eyes popped. There were four patients in the unit. Most of the time, those other three were in comas, hooked up. And most of the time, those people died. That was one of the depressing things about me. I had a beautiful suntan. I'd come back from summer in Aspen, where I was working on the book and going to music festival, and I left to work in the sun, and for a few weeks in Santa Fe, I looked beautiful until I began losing weight.
The healthiest man in intensive care.
I was in perfect health right up until the day I couldn't swallow those potatoes.
Well, the rehabilitation, when they have rowing machines and things?
No, not rowing for me. Rehabilitation for me, the main thing was. Now, I must say, with my disease, the recovery is what's called spontaneous. Tissues are destroyed by antibodies that the body produces. The body attacks itself, and these antibodies attack the tissues that cover the nerves that, as they come out of the spine. Then it stops. With me, it stopped after 12 or 14 days as a decline, and then the nerve tissue begins rebuilding itself. And there's nothing anybody or anything can do to accelerate that. My most useful exercise at the Lusk Institute, which is part of New York University Hospital, was the exercise in a pool. In a pool, one's weight becomes either 1/12th or 1/20th of its normal weight, depending on the depth of the pool, and they started me off with water up to my neck. And only in the pool could I raise my arms to exercise them, could I move my legs. It was a long time before I could raise a leg, and it was a long time before I could lift a shoulder. I could always bend my arm, but I could not extend my left shoulder, lift my left shoulder. Now, in the pool, I could exercise it. The value of that is to arrest the atrophy that's been taking place and to exercise muscles I would not be able to exercise outside the pool. So that was the most useful one.
Justice Feller, we're almost out of time. I wanted to ask you one or two.
We haven't even mentioned God Knows.
Sure. Well,
God Knows it was an awful experience. I took with the fortitude.
Yeah, you can use the word in the name of the book. God Knows it's easy. I was reading an interview that appeared with you in, I believe it was Paris Review, years ago, and I think you told the reviewer or the interviewer that you would start writing frequently with just a phrase.
That's
or
right.
A sentence.
Yes.
Now, doesn't this put a terrific burden on you as a writer not to have planned what you're going
no,
to
do? No, because I don't start. I didn't tell him I start writing. I told him the ideas from my novels come to me with sentences. And that's been true. It's been true since Catch 22, and it's true. It's true of God Knows as well. The first lines that came to me, I get in the frame of mind where I decide it's time for me to start thinking about writing another novel. I don't choose a subject. I didn't choose World War II for Catch 22. It almost chose me. The opening lines of the books come to me. Now, in production, I've seen something happen. The opening lines became the opening lines of the second chapter. With God Knows, the lines, I was sitting out in the sun. I love the sun. And I was just thinking, it's time to write another book. I had no idea what I wanted to write a book about. I thought I wanted to write a love story or a sex story. I was wondering, what would a love story be like today? But next thing I knew, I was thinking, I was saying to myself, I've got the best story in the Bible. Job, forget him. Genesis, the cosmology is for children. And I just kept thinking that. And along in that same few minutes came the idea of how to handle chronology, because I had this man say, Michelangelo made statues of us both. After Moses. He said, Moses is pretty good. Moses has I have to admit, Moses has the Ten Commandments. I've got much better lines. Michelangelo made statues of us both. The one of Moses is better. And then I knew I was talking. I was listening to the voice of King David talking as though he was somebody from Brooklyn living today. He's still on that bed of his. He's 70 years old, except now he'd be 2,000 years later. And I was thinking about writing a book about King David. And that's the way the idea for God Knows.
Subconsciously, are you with God Knows getting back to your Jewish roots, you know, catch
I hope not,
before.
Because
Bob Slocum, of course, is if anything, anti-Semitic in something happened. But then we have Good as Gold, and now we have God Knows.
I really don't know. I don't think it's not a conscious choice. As I say, I have four ideas for novels I've written in both. I was speaking right after something happened came. I was addressing a group of women in Wilmington, Delaware. In a question period, a woman said to me, Mr. Heller, how come you've never written about the Jewish experience? And I answered that. I've never been asked that question, and my reply was a joke while I tried to think of what else to say. I said, who told you I was Jewish? And then I said that I've had only two ideas in 15 or 18 years. It's not as though I rejected it. And then I took the Metroliner back to New York, and on that Metroliner, I began thinking about that question. I began making notes for a book that turned out to be Good as Gold. And one of the things that I relish is that Good as Gold begins with Bruce Gold had been asked why he'd never written about the Jewish experience before. So I have Good as Gold beginning in exactly the same way that the idea occurred to me. I don't know. I don't know what my next book will be about. I'm pretty certain it will not be about somebody being Jewish. The voice will probably be my own. The thinking will be my own because that's all I can do. It will not be in the Bible. It will not be in Coney Island.
No, it'll be something different.
Yeah.
One good thing for us consumers is that your books seem to be coming out a little quicker now than they used to.
Yeah, there was a reason for the first two with both of those, because Catch-22 was not so remunerative. I did have to do other work while I was writing Something Happened. With Something Happened, that was successful financially, so from that point on, I was able to devote my time only to working on Good as Gold, and that was done in about 4 years, which is a normal time for novels from American. There are exceptions. There are a few American novelists we have who can think with such fluency they can do a book a year, a book every year.
Asimov wrote one last week.
Well, Asimov is one, and John Updike is another, and Gore Vidal. But I'm content to do, every 4 years. God knows, it was 5 years, but I was close to a year because of the illness.
Joseph Heller, my last question, and this is just something I wanted you to clear up just for my own information. In Something Happened, Bob Slocum inadvertently smothers his son after the accident at the end of the book. And I was confused by that because I didn't know if he had really smothered, suffocated his son, or if that was sort of a metaphor.
It was the technique applied intentionally was to have it go by so quickly that the reader would not be certain whether it would happen or not. Now, Something Happened as a first-person monologue, and I was trying to present in literary form what is, I think, a familiar trick of the mind. For me, it's a psychologist trick of the mind. That is to deny that it ever happened. So it happens that quickly, and then in the closing chapter of the book, Slocum is talking about how he's gotten his promotion, how he's running the company, how well he's doing his new job, and only once is there a reference to the son. He says, "I miss my little boy." And that would be the key that it really did happen. But he is trying, which is characteristic of Slocum throughout the book, to repress everything that's unpleasant in his life. So I tried throughout Something Happened to have Slocum's, even his control of grammar. At the beginning, he meticulously, fastidiously uses simple declarative sentences. If he departs from formal English to the idiomatic, he makes it a point to let the listener or reader know that he is saying it's me instead of it is I. When he's dealing with more emotional matters like the son he has who's brain damaged or the daughter when they're not getting along, that control of grammar breaks down and then he starts going to a different speech entirely. And then at the end, as I say, he's recalling this accident because he does not want to think about it. He himself wants to pretend it never happened. It's treated that way, that swiftly. But as I say, the clue is that single sentence dropped into it's completely unrelated to what comes before. He's talking about playing at the best golf clubs. He's doing his game of golf. I forget what it is, but Biden is the thing. I miss my little boy.
Joseph Heller, our time is up. I could ask you questions from now to eternity, God knows.
Well, as you can tell, I'm happy answering them.
So I thank you very much for coming in. I know that God knows is sure to outrage and amuse your readers, and I thank you very
much. It's not an irreverent book. To end the book with a man's saying, "I want my God back," is not. It's not an atheistic book. It's not even an agnostic book. So I think before these people start, people who are sensitive to that.